going to get started again. I knew that at this stage I would have to release my own certainty about the exact sequence of things. So I've been listening as best I can to where people are and what they want to hear, and I will try to make some adjustments of the material that I have. We started a bit late. Do I have permission to go to 12:15 with you?
Yes, please.
What did you say? 12:30. It's a pleasure that at least many of you are with me here and following along. I had thought that this piece was challenging because I'd be reading and not just talking, and it just seems from what I've heard is people are following me, you're with me, you get this. Yeah. Oh, it is. Okay, well then let's keep it close to 12:15 if that's all right with you, Ellen. Here's where I want to go. I was asked if I'd read one paragraph back from what I read again about listening ourselves into being. And then there's a question of can we have the experience of a group, maybe even the brightest possible group, how it too can be subject to collective foolishness. Subject to collective foolishness. That I felt it was very important if I was going to write about collective wisdom to acknowledge that we live with varying forms of collective foolishness. And that folly is both, the way I'm using folly, is both ability to not use common sense, to not see the outcomes of our actions. But in the definition of folly is also tragic and destructive aspects. And so I'm going to take us into an example of that. I'm going to use a system I've already referred to, and I'll tell you more. And then I have some clips from movies. And I told Dixon we'd watch a little of To Kill a Mockingbird. So I think I'm going to stay with that. There's a few clips from a number of different movies I brought. And the purpose of that is I want us to begin to look at how fields of conflict can shift. So the reality of this conflict, that's why I brought Franklin here. I don't start with the assumption that everybody's going to come in just wanting to be more harmonious and know how to do it. So might as well start with a group that took cudgels to each other, spit tobacco juice in their eyes, blackmailed each other. You know, just the gang. I'm talking about the origins Sheldrake's work on morphogenic fields is wonderful because it's the beginning of trying to articulate the science of how fields recreate themselves. And when we're in these fields, to become alert to the field that is operating. And that's partly what the purpose of the show and To Kill a Mockingbird. All right, strapped in?
Yeah.
This is the section that I read that someone asked if I might read it again. He is pointing, however, to something beyond the moment, beyond signatures on a piece of paper. Democracy is a fragile agreement that depends on the arc and power of the group, of human association, and ultimately our capacity to allow reason to enter us communally. It is the power that comes from listening each other into being, into a collective being that is as conscious of its wholeness as its differences. Franklin's words foreshadow the dialogic writings of the philosopher Martin Buber and the physicist David Bohm, who asserted that, quote, real dialogue is where two or more people become willing to suspend their certainty in each other's presence. Democracy, I'm writing, is the power that issues forth from listening not only to the surface concerns and prejudices of each other, but to the deeper well of wisdom that lies in each of us and among us. So this next piece I want to prepare you for, because I feel that it's been, that there's a preparation in the group for this, and that some of you different ways have asked for this. But it is looking at the tragic consequences of collective foolishness. And my research took me, I'm not just because of, you'll come after and I'll read it to you. Anybody wants to hear Taylor Jordan? All right. I'm going to play. I'm willing to play. Can't do this for everything. When Jung lay dying over the last couple weeks of his life, there's apparently a few different stories that have emerged. One was very dark, that he had dreamed and saw a great dissolution in human society happening over the next 50 years, some of which we could say we are present to. But he also had next to his bed Chardin's book, The Phenomena of Man, of which he said was a hopeful and wonderful book. Chardin was a Jesuit priest and paleontologist. He was one of the scientific founders to fill in parts of evolution, and of course there was one little glitch. As a Jesuit priest, he was forbidden to publish much of his writing during his lifetime. In World War I, while he was a stretcher bearer, he had a vision, not unlike Edgar Mitchell's, in which he saw the crescent of the moon and imagined seeing the world from that perspective and seeing a human species. He was very struck by the biologist who coined the term biosphere for the envelope of life that human. And he developed in his writings the idea of a noosphere, that in the thinking, and by thinking he meant more than just mental activity, but in the thought that was being brought forward in the congealing of the human society, of its getting larger and forcing itself upon each other, was an envelope of thought that was rising up and holding the entirety of our conversations. And so I was going to read from The Phenomenon of Man, where he gives this an image. A glow ripples outward from the first spark of conscious reflection. The point of ignition grows larger. The fire spreads in ever-widening circles till finally the whole planet is covered with incandescence. Only one interpretation, only one name can be found worthy of this grand phenomenon. Much more coherent and just as extensive as any preceding layer, it is really a new layer, the thinking layer, which since its germination at the end of the tertiary period has spread over and above the world of plants and animals. In other words, outside and above the biosphere, there is the noosphere. It was, I placed it there because it was yet another manifestation of our thinking about what does it mean for us to be a collective being. And Chardin was one of those pioneers giving it a voice and a science. Okay. Now, let me just recover myself here. Where I am I'm going to leave this slide up. Well, actually, I wanted to give you some of the structure for folly that I followed in my writing. And the definitions are from lack of good sense to actions or conduct so misguided or unwise as to result in destructive or tragic consequences. And that's really the trajectory of this chapter of collective foolishness and its connection to tragedy. Where I will take you is into NASA. We saw yesterday the extraordinary intent and quality of some of the astronauts. But NASA holds a shadow element. And it has been in the three key disasters in its history. And I'm going to read you some of the background of the two of them. The main body of work comes from an interview with Roger Bojoli, the engineer at Morton Fickell, who had worked on the O-rings in the Challenger. And his work is public on the internet, but it was one of my colleagues who interviewed him and first provided me with this information. But it starts before that, and it's a good idea to hold the idea of morphogenic fields, that we're looking not at why did this happen, but what field has been created. "I couldn't believe it," reported Apollo astronaut John Young in the documentary In the Shadow of the Moon. He said, "I can't say anything about it or I'll get fired." He was referring to Lieutenant Colonel Gus Grissom, who was to be command pilot of the first manned Apollo launch into outer space. Young had asked about dangers from the nest of electrical wiring in the Apollo capsule. Grissom just didn't seem to want to talk about it. 2 weeks later, on January 27, 1967, during a routine training on emergency procedures, a spark of unknown origins ignited the command module, incinerating Grissom and his two fellow astronauts. Why would Grissom, a decorated Air Force pilot who flew over 100 missions in Korea and one of seven Project Mercury astronauts, hesitate to speak out about his concerns? In the last section, we saw how group polarization and overt conflict diminished a hospital response to the women dying under its care. This is another piece I'm referring to. The tragedy of the Apollo 1 astronauts offers a very different glimpse into how folly and tragedy arise. And this section is called The Tragic Silence. There are times when we need to be heard and the pressures of group life mute our speech. There are also times when the systems we have designed become so complicated and so daunting that no one individual feels their capacity to influence it. Collective foolishness often arises out of a haunting silence when words fail to pierce the resistance, fragmentation, and fear that permeate a system. We cannot see or touch the field of energy that holds these qualities, but periodically we are touched by tragedies that tell us that something terrible is present. Depth psychology has long pointed out that what the individual does not see and resolve in him or herself will appear as a negative fate. We can apply this insight to groups as well, and say what the group cannot or will not see of its own behavior reveals itself in some form of unsuspected collective tragedy. What was telling about the first Apollo mission was just how much cooperation existed. Astronauts, engineers, and managers had divided up the Herculean task of landing a man on the moon, and they worked side by side to get the job done together. It is hard to imagine a brighter, more dedicated, more loyal group of people joined together for a purpose that was personally and collectively valued. If Gus Grissom could be silenced, it is a lesson that it can happen to any of us. We do not fully know what Grissom meant when he described his reluctance to pursue the hazards of the wiring. Maybe it meant actually getting scratched from the mission, or possibly it referred to a specific conflict with another key person. It's also possible he was indicating a cumulative frustration and unwillingness to have an uncomfortable conversation on a subject he had simply given up trying to have. The complexities of their task were enormous, and the potential multiple lethal hazards included flammable materials, various wiring problems, plumbing flaws, and a hatch which might not open in an emergency. It's certainly possible, from what other astronauts reported, that the possibility of a spark in a pressurized cabin of 100% oxygen environment was just not something seriously thought through. It represented a blind spot, obvious in hindsight, but lost in the urgency of the moment. 19 years and one day later, tragedy struck again. The Challenger, carrying 7 crew members, exploded approximately a minute after takeoff. What twist of fate was this? For Roger Bojoli, a lead engineer for the solid rocket boosters that blew up, it was not an unforeseen event. In fact, a day earlier, on the anniversary of the Apollo 1 disaster, he had successfully convinced his superiors at Morton Fickle to recommend a no launch. His entire SEAL team had unanimously agreed there should not be a flight on January 28th. What happened? What happened is a tragedy made more meaningful by the absence of any ill intention. The people involved did not mean harm, but individually and collectively, they were not capable of assessing their situation. Each person felt their duty in isolation of the other, and the result was an absence of any genuine collective awareness. The collective field, similar in almost eerie way to the first Apollo disaster, was rekindled. The uncomfortable conversation that Grissom never had, or had and gave up on, was taken up again by Roger Bojoli in a conference call with 33 other key members from Morton Fickle, the NASA contractor for the rocket boosters, and NASA officials. On the night of January 27th, a conference call was organized to review the recommendation by Morton Fickle with NASA officials to cancel the launch. The engineers at Morton Fickle had unequivocally warned that the O-rings necessary to seal the joints between booster segments might not function in colder weather. The overnight temperature at the launch site was forecast to drop to 18 degrees. In fact, they were not sure the O-rings could function properly in temperatures below 53 degrees. NASA officials were alarmed and not a little bit incensed. On the conference call, the Deputy Director of Science and Engineering said he was appalled, and another key officer in the chain of command said he believed the booster had been qualified to launch at any temperatures between 40 and 90 degrees. What nonsense, another pointed out, to reset the criteria for temperature tolerance on the very eve of a launch. The launch had already been delayed 4 times, and a new delay could set it back for months. Besides, the evidence put forward was contradictory. In one case of cited, O-ring erosion occurred when it was 70 degrees outside. How could they be sure there was no correlation? How could they be sure there was a correlation between low temperatures and erosion? The engineers themselves acknowledged they did not have definitive data on O-ring performance and temperatures predicted for the next day's launch, estimated at 29 degrees. During the conference call, Roger Bojoli attempted to make an argument for caution, saying it would be away from goodness to make any recommendation other than canceling the launch. The NASA member agreed that they wanted to move in the direction of goodness if that meant a successful result for their mission. Notice the shift. What the group could not agree on was a decision about the launch. The deputy director summarized his feelings that he was seriously dismayed at the absence of evidence supporting the recommendation to cancel, but would not override a recommendation from Morton Fickle. At that point, a Morton Fickle executive requested to go offline to review their decisions. They were on a conference call in different states. The mute button was hit. It is often the case in leadership training to promote the value of individual moral courage, but less often do we recognize the group's responsibility to honor the truths held by individuals. If that was the case, leaders and group members would seek to understand more fully the knowledge held within each person, their gut, heart, and head, rather than convincing ourselves and trying to convince others that we understand the situation fully. The pressures of group life are immense, and rarely does one person want to be the one to say no when forces are gathering to say the opposite. You'll note this in the dilemmas people talk about consensus. A group is needed to seek truth from facts, both on behalf of the one who may hold an opposing view and the person who ultimately has to say yes, because the person who must say yes is equally vulnerable. Folly is most dangerous when the urge to react in a group overcomes the need for concentrated attention and ethical judgment. In the case of Morton Thiele, the view of whether to reverse their no-launch recommendation lasted for 30 minutes. Roger argued forcefully against the launch, but perceived in the end that the four key senior executives had already moved on in their attention. During the discussion, one executive spoke directly to the VP of engineering, asking him to take off his engineering hat and put on his management hat. The implication was that the complexities of the situation had to be viewed through a far more pragmatic lens. NASA was the firm's important client, and they had expectations that their company knew what they were doing, didn't they? Was there not a margin of error and secondary seals that would prevent a disaster? The senior officials at Morton Thiele were able to convince themselves that a launch was possible, and so it was, even though Roger believed not one engineer supported the decision. When the executive unmuted his phone, Morton Thiele was now recommending proceeding with the launch. There were grounds for concerns, the executive pointed out, but the data was inconclusive. A NASA executive asked over the speakerphone if anyone had a different position. There was a deafening silence. This will be repeated one more time with the Columbia disaster, and the story follows almost identically. On the launch, there was a known hit. There was a recommendation from the beginning to get satellite photographs from the military in order to have a better precise idea of where the hit was. And the culture of NASA, as much as it has a cooperative culture, convinced itself in two, I think, different ways. One is that they were always handling risk to risk. Very understandable. It's absolutely the case in hospitals. You can always be proven wrong, but the point is the person who is there has to make a decision. The discrimination here was this was not a case of risk versus risk. This was a case of not having all the information. And so it was in the Columbia, that they had convinced themselves at senior levels that there was no real damage to the area they thought had been hit, and therefore no risk to the ship. The request to get the satellite photographs did not go up through the chain of command, and so it was refused when the chain of command learned of it. A second group tasked with determining the probability of risk also asked for the film and were told that the request had already been made. They never heard more, and they began to create their own stories about why. They said, well, if it's already been made, they probably already determined that it was not on the wing. And like the story that I'm pointing out to, there was conversation about being on a low level and not wanting to speak up for being the risk, the metaphor of being fired. And I say a metaphor because I don't think Grissom could have been fired. But it's a metaphor for that feeling that no one wants to hear this anymore. And there's no yet ability to create the alliances to bring it forward, and then the separation becomes in the hierarchy from the memberships. So what I'm introducing here is something that is even beyond the group itself, and the reasons is so-and-so talks a lot, or the reason is X. Those are all also true, I mean, those internal reasons. But it shifts our awareness when we begin to say, why is this happening? What field are we in? As a positive note, when there was some concern about a later flight, it was a very open process, which again, they determined that the flight could return, but only after there was a full-fledged and very transparent process to bring all the information they had about it. So it's a hopeful note about while we repeat again and again the repetition. And to make it an analogy is to know what the difference between inner guidance and inner addictions at the personal level. That we repeat the same thing again and again and again until we learn. And we see that at a social level, at a group level and a social level. So I'm going to shift us one more time. All right? Still strapped in? Okay. We're going to take up this issue of fields again. And now we're going to ask it in a different way. Not how is it being created, but is there any clues at all to what help might shift the field? And I have actually three examples, and I'm going to stay with the one from To Kill a Mockingbird just because I think time-wise, we're going to need to be mindful. And the scene is, as some of you know the book, is in the movie version, Gregory Peck is the lawyer. He ends up defending an African-American man accused of raping a white woman. And the book is about the morphogenic field of the South in 1929 and the secrets and levels of deception that go on. And he has two children, a son and a daughter, the daughter being a feisty one, the son being a little more older and attempts to be a little more to go with the program. And the scene I'm going to show you is Gregory Peck has come in front of the jail and a mob has come to take the African-American man out of the jail. And unbeknownst to him, his two children and a friend of the two children have snuck up, and they're witnessing this mob come. And just in instinctual, they run to be with their father. And their father begins to tell them to go home. He takes up this role of, you know, you're to go home. This is not a place for you. And while he and his son begin arguing, something happens. Transformation begins. So that's where I'm going to take you. You're going to see in the first moments of the film, because I think it was beautifully done, and I'm cluing you in to, so you can follow this. It's a short scene of a farmer coming and bringing nuts as partial payment for the services that Gregory Peck had lent him. And the girl is inquisitive about this. And she learns that this is an entailment, an obligation. That is being paid back. That word entailment shows up later on in the scene, as does the farmer. So that's why you're seeing this first clip, because it introduces not only Gregory Peck and the daughter, but the farmer who shows up in the mob scene, and the word entailment. Now you may see some things as I move through these slides. Don't ask me to talk about them all. Right? Can fields be sensed? Can fields shift? Can fields be transformed?
Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. Somehow it was hotter then. Men's stiff collars wilted by 9 in the morning. Ladies bathed before noon, after their 3 o'clock nap. And by nightfall were like soft tea cakes with frostings of sweat and sweet toppings. The day was 24 hours long, but it seemed longer. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, and nothing to buy, no money to buy it with. Although Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself. That summer, I was 6 years old.
What are you, Mr. Cunningham?
Oh, morning, miss.
My daddy's getting dressed. Would you like me to call her for you?
No, miss, I don't care to bother.
Well, it's no bother, Mr. Cunningham. Very happy to see you.
Good morning, Walter. Good
morning, Mr. Finch. I didn't want to bother you none. I brought you these here hickory nuts as part of my entailment.
Well, I thank you. The collards we had last week were delicious.
Well, morning.
Morning. Scott, I think maybe next time Mr. Cunningham comes, you better not call me.
Well, I thought you'd want to thank him.
Oh, I do. I think it embarrasses him to be thanked.
Why does he bring you all this stuff?
He's paying me. There's some legal work I did for him.
Why does he pay you like this?
That's the only way he can. He has no money.
Is he poor?
Yes.
Are we poor?
We are indeed.
We as poor as the Cunninghams?
No, not exactly. Cunninghams are country folks, farmers. Crash hit them the hardest.
So just some guidance. To pay attention to feeling, to pay attention to just physical action, to use all your senses as you take this in. Okay. So we're going to go now to the mob scene.
To him. He might not like it. I just wanted to see where he was and what he was up to. He's all right. Let's go back home. Come on.
He in there, Mr. Finch?
He is. He's asleep. Don't wake him.
You know what we want. Get aside from that door, Mr. Finch.
Walter. I think you ought to turn right around and go back home. Heck, Tate's around here somewhere.
No, he ain't.
Bunches
out chasing
that old pheromone
looking for us.
You know
what
he was,
but
we come in this other way.
You ain't
never thought about that hedge, Mr.
Jensen.
I thought about it.
I can't see Atticus.
Well, that changes things.
Atticus!
Hey, Atticus. Jim, go home. And take Scout and Dill home with you. Son, I said go home.
No, sir.
Well, I'll send him home.
Don't touch him! Let him go! Let him go!
That'll do, Scout.
Ain't nobody gonna do a germ that away.
Now, you get him out of here, Mr. Finch.
Jim, I want you to please leave.
No, sir.
Jim?
I tell you, I ain't going.
Hey, Mr. Cunningham. I said, hey, Mr. Cunningham. How's your entailment getting along? Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one early morning, remember? We had a talk. I went and got my daddy to come out and thank you. I go to school with your boy. I go to school with Walter. He's a nice boy. Tell him hey for me, won't you? You know something, Mr. Cunningham? Entailments are bad. Entailments. I was just saying to Mr. Cunningham that entailments were bad, but not to worry. Takes a long time sometimes. What's the matter? I sure meant no harm, Mr. Cunningham.
No harm taken, young lady. I'll tell Walter you said hey. Let's clear out of here. Let's go, boys. I'll be there later.
Come on. Come on.
George and Dixon, if you want to help me to this is just a chance to digest and to let you speak of what you observed, what you felt, not so much questions of me, but just what happened, and to just voice it through your different eyes. So
I think the power of a relationship established. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like if you do look into somebody's eyes, there is something that makes that connection.
It's really lovely. There's a bit of a call and response. I was in a group, and a member said, "We have to see each other." And I said, that's right. You know, we have to see each other. We have to sort of understand what we each are, who we are and what we're being. He said, no, I don't mean it that way. He said, I mean we have to see each other. We have to look into each other's eyes. We have to bring our attention to see the human body, to see in that piece the pain in his eyes of the farmer in that one piece. It's just when my eyes started welling up. The beginning of something moving. There was others.
I was seeing there was I guess it's a morphogenic field there.
at first, which was the one in which caused the gang to come to attack the jail and get the prisoner out, all fueled by its own purposes and its own solidarity and all this sort of thing. And our lawyer was caught up in that, you know, as part of that field with his role in it.
That's right.
But then the kids showed up, and they're part of a different field. Yeah. They're part of that human field that we're all part of. And you had the two fields interacting, and the one was stronger. The first field couldn't live in the presence of the second. Mm-hmm. It wasn't dissipated entirely, but it couldn't stand with its full strength.
I'm struck. I'm feeling grateful. And the gratitude has to do with your gift, which has taken bits and pieces of things with which I am familiar and given new breath, which I'm able to receive, and I'm very grateful to you.
And what I saw at the end was that there's an argument between the group and Atticus, and Atticus will not move. Mm. Mm. And then there's an argument between Atticus and the son, and he will not move. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, something new happens, and the father has the wisdom to suspend things so that the new can enter and to let her speak.
I'm amazed. I have seen this scene numerous times, and yet I saw it with new eyes today. I saw Atticus treating the mob as a mob, speaking to them as a mob. She saw them as individuals and spoke to him as an individual.
Did I see a significant body language when he was sitting there with his crotch open?
I would just, it struck me that it was a shift from the power chakra to the heart chakra, and the accompanying field. Mm-hmm.
What struck me is my grandfather was a farmer and had seven children, and they didn't struggle during the Depression for food that much because they had a farm. And so they were rich in food. And, you know, in some levels, this man was poor. You know, he didn't have finery and maybe a car or whatever, but yet he was providing things for, you know, not just Atticus, but maybe for a whole community. And maybe she saw through some of that because she was so grateful for some of the things that he had brought.
Perhaps a sign of the time of the filmmaking, but there was no dramatic music around any of this. And there was a palpable silence behind the little girl's voice, even though there was a mob around. And then after she spoke, there was silence. Well, it kind of set in with the mob.
Don't want to take it to the theoretical, but I will. I was thinking in Jungian terms of how the little girl is bringing in the young feminine to the Apollonian stuck masculine.
we could spend a whole week on weekend on this movie. One of my favorite scenes is in the courthouse after the case is over, and all the black people are sitting in the balcony, and the children are up there with the minister, and Scout is sitting down, and everyone else has left except Atticus at the front, and these people, these black people all stand up, and he says, "Scout, Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing." So they all waited for him to leave.
One or two more, if there's a impulse for that.
I'm struck by the realization that we talk about a collective unconscious in terms of a larger group. And yet, that group, that family unit, there was respect and all the positive aspects in order for the children to have the courage to even come and stand by his side. So he embodied whatever that wisdom was within the family unit. And I take away what is the dynamic within my family unit, because that's certainly a big part of this.
Alan, one of the things that I noticed about the scene was when Scout takes the responsibility of modeling a mistake. And here she is, she's a child, and she says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned the entailment." And that was such a small thing. And it made all those guys realize what a wrong they were contemplating.
Beautiful. I want to, in a sense, turn the attention back to you, that when catalyzed, I'm tearing up listening to you all. If you, the different ways of seeing this, it's just gorgeous, from noticing the sound of the silence to the metaphysics of the situation and archetypes of the situation to the moment of vulnerability that is often the shifting place for Fields. If there is one or two more, but I want to bring us home safely. So,
I was just thinking of the tragic silence that you talked about before, and how the little girl's voice was allowed to speak by both the father and the group, and how if she hadn't spoken, what the tragic consequences would have been. And kind of turning it over in my mind to the tragic consequences of our not reacting, like we have for 40 years to the warming of the earth and the war in Iraq and all that, that this has been allowed to go on because we've been afraid to really speak out and suffer the consequences of speaking out.
One more. I agree that we could go the afternoon on this clip.
The part that most moved me was the look on Cunningham's face when you could see his mind.
Thank you for that.
I just feel compelled to point out, though, that a tragedy is postponed and not prevented.
That's right. That's right.
The innocent black man is shot while trying to escape.
That's right. Not trying to escape.
Well, we're encouraged to think of that drama, but the larger forces are not vanquished.
Thank you. C, did you want? Did you? Yeah. So let us agree that this is an unfinished conversation. I want to bring to closure with some of Howard Thurman's words. Yes, Howard Thurman, who I really found in the end to be in a dialogue with Jung. Jung saying that the alchemical work is at its core about shadow, about the opposition. And the first period of negredo, the darkness that begins the alchemical process. And Thurman answering from his own life experience as an African-American born in the South and seeking, in one of his greatest books, Seeking Common Ground. And he writes, in the conflicts between man and man, between group and group, between nation and nation, the loneliness of the seeker for community is sometimes unendurable. The radical tension between good and evil, as man sees it and feels it, does not have the last word about the meaning of life and the nature of existence. There is a spirit in man and in the world working always against the thing that destroys and lays waste. Always against all that fragments and shatters, and against things that separate and divide within and without, life labors to melt together into a single harmony. In all these things, there is a secret door which leads into the central place where the creator of life and the God of the human heart are one and the same. Let's take a final meditation with the words of Rumi as read by Coleman Barks.
There is some kiss we want with our whole lives. Touch the spirit on the body. There is some kiss we want with our whole lives. The touch of spirit on the body. Seawater begs the pearl to break its shell. Seawater begs the pearl to break its shell. And the lily, how passionately it needs some wild dark. And the lily, how passionately it needs some wild dark. Press its face against mine. Close the language door and open the love window.
Thank you. Thank you so much.